Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So in this episode, I'm talking about progesterone, specifically what's happening to it as we move into perimenopause and why that matters. And how we can support it, because it really does matter. And it is important that we understand why, because that can also help us to make sense of any various symptoms that we might be suffering with and not really understanding where they're coming from and why this, what might feel like a sudden change. So in episodes 2 and 3, I explained what's actually happening with your hormones as we move into perimenopause and through it. So do go back and listen to those two if you haven't already. And in this episode, I just wanted to do a deeper dive into progesterone specifically. And next week, I'll be doing a deeper dive into estrogen specifically. So if you listen to those two episodes, episodes 2 and 3, you'll remember that perimenopause is essentially a change in our hormonal landscape. It's not menopause. It's everything that comes before menopause. It's the build up to it, which does begin from sort of mid to late 30s. Now, progesterone is the first of the two ovarian hormones. So out of estrogen and progesterone, progesterone is the first one to start to shift as we move from our sort of mid to late 30s into our 40s. It basically starts to decline. So that's what's happening. That's the characteristic of that shift in progesterone. And that's a really important part of perimenopause physiology to understand, because the effects of that can be significant. And if we don't realize that that's going on, and we don't realize that we can actually support it with our habits, our day-to-day nutrition and lifestyle habits, then, you know, we can just, this massive stone that we're leaving unturned when it comes to supporting ourselves and helping ourselves to feel better. So that's what I'm hoping that you will get from this episode. You'll get a nice insight into what's actually happening and then what you can do. So first of all, let's talk about exactly what progesterone is and what it does. So it is one of the two so-called sex hormones, or ovarian hormones, or some people call them reproductive hormones. So the two hormones made by our ovaries that go through the change, like a sort of, you know, change in their behavior as we move into perimenopause. But progesterone is made during the process of ovulation, or after the process of ovulation. As a result of ovulating, the body makes progesterone. And I'll talk more about that a bit later on. So it's basically made once a month after ovulation, and it sticks around for about a couple of weeks, continues to be produced for a couple of weeks after the initial production of it. So I'll go into that more in a little bit. But it's basically a steroid hormone, and the term steroid refers to, as is estrogen as well, as it refers to a group of hormones that are made in the body from cholesterol. So that's why a little clue there is important, that we do eat cholesterol. We do get, you know, we do eat good fats in the diet, because cholesterol is actually helping to make these hormones. And steroid hormones act as what's known as like chemical messengers in the body. So basically they travel around your bloodstream to different tissues and organs, sending important messages that these tissues and organs respond to and act accordingly. So we've got progesterone receptors, like little doorways for it, on the cells within many systems throughout the body, if not all of them. So it's not just about the reproductive system, the menstrual cycle, you know, hormone, like reproduction sort of health. It affects so much more, as does estrogen. So these progesterone receptors, or doors on the cells, are found in lots of different tissues and organs, as I said, in lots of different systems. And that's why progesterone impacts a wide range of bodily functions, physiological functions, that go way beyond the menstrual cycle and fertility. So for example, the brain and the nervous system is a really big one. And that's why a lot of the symptoms associated with declining progesterone are related to the brain and the nervous system. So progesterone has a neuroprotective, or brain, that's what neuro means, protective effect, because it supports a process called myelination. That process is basically the forming of a protective layer around our nerve cells. So if you think of each nerve cell as a pipe that you might find in your loft or a bathroom, and the insulated layer that we see wrapped around some of these pipes is the myelin sheath. So the process of myelination is the building up of that protective layer around our nerve cells. So that supports, the more obviously protective layers we have around our nerve cells, our neurons, that supports the function of our brain, both now and our future brain health as well. So, you know, protects us from brain degenerative diseases later in life, like dementia and Alzheimer's. And it also helps, progesterone also helps to regulate our mood and our cognition. So our focus, our memory, our ability to learn. And that's why low progesterone levels during perimenopause can cause or contribute to mood swings, anxiety, low mood, irritability, brain fog, because it's so important for these different processes. And if it's low, we're going to start experiencing various symptoms related to the brain. So also progesterone can convert into a brain hormone called allopregnanolone, which increases the actions of a brain chemical called GABA. So GABA is calming, it's anti-anxiety, it supports our sleep. It's a brain chemical that's very calming and anti-anxiety. So we want to be able to make GABA. And without this allopregnanolone, which progesterone can convert into, this brain hormone, the stress response system, basically our nervous system, can become destabilized, because GABA would have helped to stabilize it and keep things sort of calm. So when that happens, we can start to feel symptoms of heightened anxiety. We might have trouble sleeping, trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, or both. We might just start to feel less resilient to stress, or have this sort of reduced ability to cope with our life load or stressors, because progesterone supports the nervous system and the stress response. So lower levels can start to cause this, this destabilization essentially of our nervous system. And also progesterone, declining levels of progesterone can start to cause cortisol levels to naturally rise, which is the stress hormone, which basically means it can cause the adrenal glands, your stress hormone producing glands, to start producing more cortisol. So I did mention this in previous episodes, but that there's an episode, I think it's episode 6 or 7 maybe, which is all about cortisol and the stress response. And what I said there is that the declining levels of progesterone and the new erratic nature of estrogen in perimenopause starts to mean that cortisol levels naturally are higher in the body. So there's kind of lots of different reasons why our stress response system, nervous system, starts to become dysregulated. And also progesterone can influence insulin sensitivity, which we want. We want our cells to be sensitive to insulin, and we want good blood sugar regulation. And progesterone has an influence on those two things. Progesterone is also anti-inflammatory. It supports the thyroid gland. It can prevent water retention throughout the body. So that sort of puffiness that we might start to experience more so in our 40s. And it supports the immune system. So while you might know progesterone is the hormone that prepares the lining of the uterus, which is why it's sort of made after ovulation specifically, it supports the lining of the uterus to hold and grow a pregnancy. But we now know it is needed for so much more than that. So each month after ovulation, lots of lovely progesterone is produced, which makes the uterine lining fluffy and hospitable for a potential egg to implant itself, get cozy and grow. And if a pregnancy doesn't occur, then the lining, that endometrium lining, starts to break down, it sheds, and that's the start of our next period, which is day one of a new cycle. But as I said, fertility aside, your body and brain really need this wonderful hormone to promote a sense of contentment with ourselves, our life, a sense of equilibrium and just general well-being, to support deep, restful sleep, to increase that lovely brain chemical we just talked about, GABA, which reduces anxiety and promotes calm and relaxation. We need it to support our brain, support cognition, focus, concentration, memory, to protect the brain cells as well, our neurons, from degeneration. We need it to boost our metabolism because it has a thermogenic effect, which means it can help to raise body temperature, which increases our metabolism. It helps our thyroid gland to actually make enough thyroid hormone. It helps you release excess body fluid, so therefore preventing that puffiness, menstrual bloating. It protects, as I said, the neurons of the brain, which also helps to support healthy blood flow to the brain. So lots of brain stuff here with progesterone. It helps to manage emotional symptoms like mood swings, irritability, by helping to stabilize the stress hormones and the nervous system. So all that being said, we can see there's lots of brain stuff here, lots of anxiety, calm, sleep, protective benefits from progesterone. But let's also look at the effects of low progesterone on the activity of estrogen and how that shows up for us symptoms wise each month. So progesterone and estrogen, they work together across the month. That's why we have these two hormones ebbing and flowing throughout the month of the menstrual cycle. I talked more about this in episode 3. So estrogen, specifically estradiol, is made every day in the menstrual cycle, with levels slowly starting to increase from a few days into your period. It's what's known as a proliferative hormone, meaning it builds things up. So in this case, I'm talking about the endometrium, the lining of the uterus. It helps to stimulate the growth of the thickening of this endometrium, which creates this sort of well-developed thick layer of cells, like a wall, the uterine lining wall. Progesterone, on the other hand, is made after ovulation, so around halfway through the cycle, and it takes over during this second half of the cycle, takes over from estrogen. And its role is to transform that thickened endometrial lining, that wall, into a nourishing environment by increasing the sort of blood supply and the like glandular secretions, which helps to make that lining softer, more fluffy, rich in nutrients. And that prepares it for the potential implantation of a fertilized egg. So having estrogen met with progesterone after ovulation each month is hormonal balance. It's also known as opposed estrogen, where estrogen is opposed or balanced out by its partner hormone. I like to call it, and as a lot of other practitioners do as well, progesterone is estrogen's calming best friend. So it's the, you know, it comes to calm down those proliferative growth effects. It comes along and says, okay, you've done enough growing. Let's stop now and just calm things down. So that is hormone balance. The opposite of having opposed or balanced estrogen with progesterone, the opposite of that is estrogen dominance or unopposed estrogen, meaning estrogen was not opposed by its partner hormone, progesterone. So that would occur, for example, if we don't ovulate some or many months of our menstrual cycle. If we don't manage to ovulate, then we don't make progesterone. So balancing estrogen out with progesterone helps to prevent heavy or painful periods, because progesterone prevents the further building up of that lining that estrogen was doing before. And therefore that helps to lighten the next period. So progesterone is like a period lightening hormone. It also prevents PMS symptoms. It prevents menstrual bloating, breast pain, because it prevents the proliferation of breast tissue by estrogen, which is another thing it's doing. It's building up the lining, but it can also be proliferating the breast tissue. So if we get progesterone coming halfway through the cycle, then that helps to slow that proliferation down and prevent the breast pain. Progesterone will also help to prevent headaches associated with PMS, mood swings, any of these kind of typical PMS symptoms. So we can basically see that progesterone is like the yin to estrogen's yang. It shelters the body and the breast tissues from the effects of having too much estrogen, or, as we said, estrogen that isn't opposed or balanced out by its partner. So if, as long as ovulation occurs and estrogen is met with progesterone, perimenopause symptoms month after month can be minimized by basically the fact that we're helping to maintain balanced hormone levels, which is always going to be trickier during perimenopause because perimenopause essentially is hormonal imbalance. That's, you know, estrogen starts to go on an erratic roller coaster, levels really high 1 minute, really low the next. And physiologically, progesterone levels do start to decline. It is harder to make progesterone as we move through our 40s, but we can support that. And that's what's really great. So some studies actually show that lack of progesterone can lead to regular or much heavier periods than normal during perimenopause. So it is a characteristic of perimenopause that we start to have irregular periods in our kind of later stages of perimenopause, especially the closer we get to actually going 12 months without a period and reaching menopause. It is completely natural that our periods are going to get more and more irregular, and long, you know, cycles are going to get longer and longer over time. And it's also characteristic of perimenopause that our periods get heavier. But lack of progesterone, and that, you know, that it, one of the reasons for that is lack of progesterone, but we can support it as much as possible. We can't make it as great as it was in our 20s and 30s, but we can support it so that it doesn't have to be as bad as what some people do experience. So let's just have a look at how we do make progesterone. So I've said we make it as a result of ovulation, but how exactly is it made? So during ovulation, a tiny little random gland, temporary gland, gets formed. And that gland is called the corpus luteum. So this is an amazing little gland. Like I said, it's just temporarily formed after or sort of during the ovulation process. And it allows one of your ovaries to release a nice load of progesterone into your system after ovulation has taken place. It forms, this corpus luteum forms very quickly, and it lives on for about 11 to 14 days. So this is the approximate length of an average luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. Let's say the average menstrual cycle is around 28 days. They can rate, normal cycles go anywhere from sort of 25 to 35 days, but let's just use the average length of 28. So this means that the corpus luteum lives on continuing to produce progesterone for about the last couple of weeks of the cycle up until we come on our period again. So it's constantly releasing progesterone into the system for the last 2 weeks of the cycle. And the first 2 weeks of the cycle, from day one of our period up to ovulation, we naturally do not have any progesterone. We're not making any, we're making estrogen, but we're not making progesterone until we've ovulated. So no ovulation means no progesterone production. And therefore, we have what's known as an estrogen dominant cycle or an unopposed estrogen cycle, because it's just we just have estrogen. We don't actually have any progesterone. Sometimes we can ovulate, but not do it optimally. And therefore, we do make progesterone. The corpus luteum is formed, but it's not formed as optimally as normal. And we just don't make as much progesterone as we could. We don't make optimal levels, but that's still better than having none at all. And just one thing to note, that obviously what I'm talking about is people who aren't using the oral contraceptive pill or the injection or the implant, because what those things are doing is they're there, that the reason for them is to block the brain and ovary communication. So it sort of shuts down. It suppresses ovulation, right? That's the whole idea of the contraceptive medication, is to shut down ovulation, prevent it from happening. So then we're not having this natural cycling of estrogen and progesterone anyway. But what's important to note there is that if you are on any of those kind of medications, you're not actually getting any progesterone from them. Some, you get what's called progestins, which is the synthetic form of progesterone. It's not the same as progesterone. So all of those kind of benefits I just talked through about progesterone, we don't get those from progestins. Unfortunately, we only get it from the real thing, or if we replace later down the line through perimenopause, if we choose to use body identical progesterone capsules, then that is progesterone. But if we're on any oral contraceptive medication or a hormonal IUD, then that's got progestin as opposed to progesterone. So that's just a little side note. But going back to people on having natural cycles, it's possible to track. You're probably wondering, well, how do I know if I ovulate? you're saying all this about ovulation is how we make progesterone, but I don't track ovulation. Why would I? I'm not trying to get pregnant. I'm done with all that or whatever. So how do I know I've ovulated? The kind of easiest way to know is to track your baseline body temperature every morning. So for example, as soon as you wake up, before you get out of bed, just roll over and grab a thermometer that you could leave by your bed every night, and just put it in your mouth, take your temperature. It's a nice sort of way to just lie there for a minute as well without just running out of bed and starting your day. And then just note down what your temperature was. So you could use a notebook or you can put it into a cycle tracking app. I use an app called Cycles, which is free. They do have a paid version, but the free version is fine for me because I'm just using it to put my, just to track my temperature. This is also known as tracking your basal body temperature, or BBT, they call it as well. So what you're looking for is, once you have, you might take a 2 or 3 months to really look at trends, but once you have a good idea of what your normal sort of baseline morning temperature is between day one and up to just before you ovulate, so what you want to do is figure that out first. So this is why, you know, you don't really get much information from just doing it from the first month. So the if you want to start doing this, if you haven't been doing it already, wait for day one of your next period. Start tracking, taking your body temperature every day throughout that whole sort of two-ish weeks, let's say, up until, and then keep doing it. On the day that you suspect you're going to ovulate, what you want to see is the day after ovulation, that first morning that you wake up, you want to see a slight increase in temperature. So you'd ideally want to see that your temperature was a certain level. So for example, mine in Celsius between day one and up to ovulation is between 36.2 and 36.4 usually. And then you want to see a slight increase if you've ovulated. So that would be anywhere between about 0.1 degrees Celsius to 0.3 degrees Celsius. So after estimated ovulation day, you want to see this slight increase, but you also want to see that this slight increase has been sustained until the day after your next period has come. So for example, mine spikes a little bit from the average of sort of 36.2 or 3 or 4. Mine, after the day that I'm supposed to have ovulated, has spiked up to about 36.6 or 7, and it stays at 36.6 or 36.7 for the next 2 weeks. And the day I come on my period, the next morning, I've got a low reading again, back down to around 36.2 for about 2 weeks again, and so on and so on. So hopefully that makes sense. So because basically progesterone increases body temperature slightly, so that's how you sort of know, yeah, I must have ovulated because the temperature's gone up, but it's stayed up. So I have ovulated and I've made progesterone and I'm continuing to make it until your next period comes. So the day before, roughly the day before we're due on again, estrogen and progesterone both kind of take a little bit of a nosedive. So temperature would go back down again, sort of day one of your next period, and then it starts to climb again once you ovulate. So why, you can also use ovulation strips. I haven't actually used them before, but I think just using the, just, you know, just investing in a good quality thermometer and just taking that every morning is quite effective. So let's look at why it starts to decline, why progesterone starts to decline. So basically, it's, in a nutshell, it's because ovulation starts to become harder to achieve as we move past 40. And that's just due to the characteristics of perimenopause. What it actually is that there's a change in communication between the brain and the ovaries, that kind of talk between the two starts to break down, which is essentially what perimenopause is. And I've explained that in detail in episodes 2 and 3. So that breakdown in communication between your brain and your ovaries is what puts estrogen on its sort of erratic roller coaster and prevents the ovaries from getting a message from the brain to ovulate. So, or sometimes they do get the message, but they only hear it a few days later. So they ovulate later in the cycle. So you might start to find that you do manage to ovulate, but it's much later in the cycle. So you're having kind of longer, a longer follicular phase, which is the first couple of weeks they might of the cycle, that might just extend because you ovulate a bit later. And it might mean that you have a shorter luteal phase, so you have less time enjoying the benefits of progesterone. It's still better than not having any at all, but that can also lead to various symptoms as well. So basically, the brain no longer talks to the ovaries as loudly or clearly as timely as it did in your 20s and 30s, and or your ovaries no longer hear your brain talking to them as well as they did before. Or like I said, they might hear, but just a few days too late. So the good news, as I mentioned earlier as well, is that we can support our body to ovulate more months than it might have done if we didn't intervene. And that can significantly start to ease symptoms. And that's the beauty of nutrition and lifestyle habits, like the beauty of using our habits that we perform every day or don't perform. We can leverage them to support our body to ovulate, despite the fact that it's naturally physiologically harder to achieve ovulation after 40. And that is just so great, this is why I do the job that I do, which I have spoken about in previous episodes. So for example, for me at almost 45, I'm still managing to ovulate every month. So I do track my temperature every morning. And every month around day 15, I see this slight rise in temperature, and it's sustained daily until my next period comes. I'd say over the last two or more years, I can definitely count on one hand, I'd say maybe three occasions where that temperature spike hasn't happened. And then I've known, like I've kept checking it, and it's just never gone up. It's been the same. And I say to I haven't ovulated, but I always know why. And I'm never actually surprised, because it's been, like I said, this maybe three occasions in the last two or so years where it's been an unusually stressful month. Or I've had, for example, last year I had a significant loss in the family, and I thought, I'm not going to ovulate next month. You know, my next cycle is not going to be an easy one. And there it wasn't. You know, I see there's no spike in temperature. But then the next month it comes back. So like I said, in two or more years, I've only had about three months sporadically spread out where I haven't had that temperature spike. And then what's happened is I felt that by way of symptoms. So how that's shown up for me is in the second half of that cycle where I didn't get the temperature spike, my sleep's been really off. I've had heightened anxiety. Then I've had breast pain in the build up to my period coming, usually starting a lot earlier than just a few days before, maybe even sort of 10 days before my period. And it's just been sustained breast pain until my period's come, and then it disappears. And then when my period has come, it's been really, really heavy and crampy and maybe even clotty. So that's how it shows up for me, and I think a lot of other people as well, when they have low progesterone. But as I said, because of all the work that I do, I know that if I wasn't doing the things that I do, nutrition-wise, lifestyle, habit-wise, these non-ovulatory cycles that I've counted on one hand would definitely be much more frequent, and I'd be without progesterone a lot more than I am. So the take-home message there is that, again, there's things that we can do to support ourselves every day. And it's just learning what those things are and making them habit, just making them part of our new identity or behavior, and saying, right, you know, these are the things that support happier hormones and a happier time during perimenopause and a much easier transition into menopause when the time comes. So let's just recap the typical symptoms of low progesterone. So when it's low, so either you didn't make any at all, it usually shows up if you're not making it more months than you are, you would experience the symptoms that I've already mentioned and what I'm going to recap now, more on an ongoing basis, versus like me, if you only don't ovulate really sporadically sometimes and it's just a one-off, you might experience the symptoms of low progesterone, but then they go away. And then the following month, when you do ovulate and make progesterone again, you go back to feeling okay again. It's really when someone's had consistent months, multiple months, where they're just not managing to ovulate, that they really, you know, it starts to build up. Their time without progesterone just gets more and more intense, and they can start to experience trouble sleeping. So it could be, they might describe it as insomnia, particularly during the second half of their cycle. It could be there all month, but just worse in the second half of their cycle. anxiety that's, again, particularly heightened during the second half of the cycle. Symptoms of the typical symptoms of unopposed estrogen or estrogen dominance. So the miserable, heavy periods, clotting, breast pain, mood swings, even some rage. So more than just irritable, actually quite angry, headaches, growth of fibroids. If you're noticing that, cyst growth as well. You might be feeling more stress sensitive, less resilient, less able to cope. Again, irritable. Migraines just before or during your period. That's quite a significant sign of progesterone. Could be lots of other things as well, which we'll talk about in the estrogen episode next week. Water retention. So again, that sort of puffiness, usually around the ankles, the hands and feet. Spotting or breakthrough bleeding during the second half of your cycle. So breakthrough bleeding basically is spotting. It's basically just finding, you know, blood that, you know, maybe day 20 or even sort of day 16 or day 23, when you're just like not expecting your period, and then it goes away and then your period comes as normal when it's due. It could be shorter cycles, so going less than 25 days. Mine have now gone down to 25 days. So I was always 28 days like clockwork for years and years. And then they slowly went down to 27 days, slowly went down to 26 days since this is all from turning 40. And then now they are slowly making their way down to 25, which is still in the normal range of like normal cycle lengths. But once they go down to sort of less than 25, it could be a, you know, sign that you're not ovulating, you have no progesterone. But also longer cycles or irregular cycles can be a characteristic as well, due to the sort of less frequent ovulation. So how can we encourage ovulation and support progesterone levels? So now that we know we only make it through monthly ovulation, we want to support, in order to basically achieve ovulation each month, we want to be supporting our health as a whole all the time. So we also want to be identifying any potential obstacles to our ability to ovulate. And those include stress. Stress is huge, probably one of the biggest blockers to managing to achieve ovulation. For me, those few times I've noticed my temperature increase hasn't happened, it has always been due to a particularly stressful month, the month before. Any sort of chronic inflammation going on in the body is basically an ongoing stressor. So that can cause issues with ovulation. Also, if we have acute inflammation, so for example, if a month that you've had COVID, you're very, you know, it's likely that you won't manage to ovulate next time it's due. That's definitely happened to me. I've had COVID three times, and that's happened. I haven't managed to ovulate the following month. I have once, I think, but a couple of times I haven't. And because it's such a huge stressor, all of your body's resources are poured into fighting that, you know, infection, that it kind of pulls resources from everywhere else, and it's a stressor. Any underactive thyroid or overactive thyroid issues, having insulin resistance, which is an episode we'll do separately, having any nutrient deficiencies, because there's certain nutrients that are very important for our ability to ovulate. And also things like undereating, very low calorie diets, low fat diets, over fasting, you know, fasting to the point where you're not actually, you're now under eating because you're not eating as many meals as you ideally should. So let's just go through six ways to support ovulation, because this will help where I said, you know, identify any potential obstacles, which sounds quite negative when I go through that list. If we actually reframe that to look at ways to support it, we are then going to sort of support those obstacles anyway. Okay, so the first one, manage stress and minimize its impact. So as I said, stress is a big one, because chronic stress is one of the biggest blockers to ovulation. Because your brain is always scanning your environment, always. Your brain and your brain, and then sending signals down to the rest of your nervous system, which is essentially your adrenal glands form part of that, you know, your stress response system. Your brain is always scanning your environment for any threats to any, you know, your life or the potential baby, essentially, because if you ovulate, if the brain allows you to ovulate, it tells your ovaries to do so, there's a chance that there could be a new life there. So it needs to scan your environment all the time for any threats. This is one of the reasons why women are usually more sensitive to stress than men, because the brain is it's built that way. It's always looking for any threat, basically, to your survival or a new life survival. If it senses any threat, then it's not going to send a signal down to your brain, to your ovaries, to tell your ovaries to ovulate. And therefore, they don't get a signal. And then we don't ovulate. But the annoying thing is, we can't just say to our brain, look, we're not trying to get pregnant. Maybe some of you are. And I hope that this, you know, this, what we're discussing in this episode today doesn't kind of trigger any negative emotions. I just really have to talk this through to explain, you know, what's going on here. So we can't just unfortunately tell our brain, look, we're not trying to get pregnant. We just want to ovulate so that we can have progesterone. That's all we want. The brain just, you know, it's black and white for the brain. So the brain, you know, we also can't say to the brain, look, we're not this particular stressor, you know, being stuck in traffic and having a troublesome teenager or worrying about an aging parent isn't a threat to my life. Don't worry. You know, you can still tell my ovaries to ovulate. We can't do that. So that's another thing that this is where stress management becomes so important. So things like having too much on our plate every day, working long hours, having financial worries, having work or relationship issues, issues with our children, as I said, being stuck in traffic every day, rushing every day, spending too much time scrolling or doom scrolling, running late all the time. All of these things are sensed by the brain as a threat. So again, we don't get that signal down to the ovaries to ovulate, and therefore we don't ovulate and we don't get any progesterone. So if this is a chronic, you know, stress is chronic for you, it's definitely something to think about. Because this, you know, now starts to leave us with these estrogen dominant cycles every month where we're not having estrogen met by its partner calming hormone. And then the next period is heavy, it's painful. Our PMS is awful. We've got breast pain, we've got headaches, we're having trouble sleeping, we've got more anxiety. So managing stress better can really help to alleviate the physical symptoms that I just mentioned and those emotional symptoms as well, and just improve our overall well-being. So some of my favorite ways to manage stress through the day, through the week, and sort of reduce these physiological stress response are things like using regular deep breathing exercises. So even just for 3 minutes, right? So first thing in the morning, instead of just jumping out of bed and just rushing off and maybe grabbing your phone and going down rabbit holes, looking at your phone, checking emails, checking WhatsApps, checking the news, we should really spend even just 3 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes with just ourselves. And maybe just sit up at the end of your bed. So maybe after you've taken your temperature, which, like I said, is a nice thing to do because it stops you rushing out of the bed. Because to take your temperature each morning, your baseline temperature, you do have to do it before you've even got up. So do that. And then maybe you could sit on the end of your bed or even just stay lying down and spend 3 minutes doing something known as the 4-6 breathing routine. So this is breathing in very gently through your nose with your mouth closed to a count of 4 seconds, and then the same breathing out to a count of 6 seconds. It's as simple as that. So if you just count the breath, count to 4, then breathe out, count to 6, breathe in, count to 4, breathe out, count to 6, and so on for about 2 to 3 minutes, you'll probably feel it within a minute. This, if you're someone who wakes up feeling maybe a bit anxious and rushy, like go, 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 let's go, and feeling a bit on edge about what's to come that day, then you'd usually start to feel this within a minute, this sort of calm just coming over you. And then it's a great tool to tap into throughout the day. So after a stressful meeting, or, you know, if you've been stuck in traffic and you're rushing somewhere, can you just stop somewhere for 3 minutes or 2 minutes to just do this breath again? Anytime we just get a bit of space and time, we can just tune into that 4-6 breathing. Again, at night before, or like when we get into bed, I always do it when I lay down into bed. I always just do this 4-6 breathing for a couple of minutes and then maybe read a bit of my book, and or do it the other way around, read my book and then do the breathing. And it really just helps me to fall asleep as well. Spending time in nature or any kind of green space or woodland, even just 10 minutes a day. If you can do 10 minutes twice a day, that would be great. There's loads of research into the effects of green space and how when we see it, when we look at woodland or green space, or, you know, nature generally, it sends calming signals to the brain. That's what the regular, the deep breathing exercises do as well. It switches off that stress response. It tells the brain, I'm safe, everything's okay. You don't need to be keeping me in this fight or flight stress response. And I talk a lot about this in, I think it's episode 7, where I'm talking about, or it might be episode 8, but you'll see in the title, it's cortisol, basically, is the title of the episode. Gentle yoga, Tai Chi or Qigong, any of those three, because it's really focusing on the breath. It's the mind-body connection. So that, again, has been shown to calm the stress response. Even just 5 minutes or 10 minutes, it doesn't have to be a 60-minute class once a week. In fact, research shows that just doing it little and often throughout the week is actually more effective. So even just 5 or 10 minutes a day or every other day. Saying or writing down some things that you're grateful for first thing in the morning or last thing at night or both, ideally. So you can say them aloud to yourself. But it has been shown, the research has shown that actually the act of writing it down, pen to paper, is actually more effective at relieving stress. So just simply writing really quickly, you know, it could take you 30 seconds to just think of three things that you're grateful for in your life or in that particular day, and just jot them down. It can be a notebook, a fancy journal, a piece of paper, whatever. That has been shown to be quite powerful. Also doing yoga nidra. So this is also known as non-sleep deep rest or NSDR. It is essentially just lying down meditation. So you can get comfortable on a mat on the floor or in your bed. And you're just listening to this meditation, which is essentially a body scan. So it's guiding you through different parts of the body. And that has been shown to be very effective at turning off the stress response as well. And you can find them online. You can find them on YouTube. You can find them on different apps. I use an app called Insight Timer. And they range from 8 minutes to 40 minutes, you know, anywhere in between. Just find a duration that works for you. So if you work from home, you could maybe do it before lunch in a lunch break, or you could do it after a meeting, have a mat laid out. I always have my mat laid out by my desk at home to be able to go out and go down and do that. I think we could talk through this for hours, but I go back to the cortisol episode, which I think is one or two before this one. And we've talked through some other sort of key ways to support stress, but those are really, really the key ones that I've just described. Secondly, we want to be supporting our thyroid health. So now is the time to be keeping an eye on important thyroid function markers as we become more prone to thyroid imbalances as we move through perimenopause, and that can impact our ability to ovulate. So hypothyroidism, for example, underactive thyroid can affect our ability to ovulate. So the key markers that we want to be testing for include free T4, free T3, TSH, and also the two main thyroid antibodies, which are known as antithyroid peroxidase, which is also abbreviated to TPO, and antithyroglobulin antibody, which is usually abbreviated to TGAB. So ideally once a year at least, checking your thyroid markers. Monitoring these markers is really important. As I said, thyroid function significantly impacts hormone levels, our ability to ovulate, impacts our menstruation as well, heavy periods, mood regulation around our period as well. And the trouble with conventional thyroid testing, if you would just go to your GP, for example, is unfortunately they're still today only looking at TSH and T4, which is helpful, but it doesn't provide the full picture. So we also want to know how much of that T4, which is essentially thyroid hormone, is being converted once we release it in the body from the thyroid gland. T4 needs to be converted into what's known as T3, which is the active thyroid hormone. It's the one that does all the work, basically. So even if we have healthy levels of T4, which your GP can test for, we need to know, is that being converted into enough T3? Because if it's not, then we'll have essentially underactive thyroid symptoms. So we want to look at T3 as well. And we also ideally want to look at those two antibodies, which can tell us whether we have any autoimmunity destruction happening to the thyroid gland, which can also cause hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid. So with my clients privately, I'll use labs like Genova Diagnostics. But if you want to use a DIY version, I usually recommend MediCheck. So you can purchase online through them. And they have their own sort of doctors that work with them as well, and they're fully regulated. So very important that we're checking thyroid as well. Then we want to be checking for, or sort of essentially preventing or reversing, the situation of insulin resistance. Now, I'll do a whole episode on insulin resistance, why it matters, how it happens, how to support it. But for the purposes of today's episode, we're basically talking about blood sugar balance, essentially, because blood sugar balance is the foundational pillar for hormone health and how we experience perimenopause and move into menopause. And if we have good blood sugar regulation, we're going to either prevent or reverse insulin resistance, because that comes after a period of time where our blood sugar hasn't been managed well. So essentially, managing insulin resistance, whether we want to prevent it from occurring or reverse it, comes down to eating a blood sugar balancing diet that contains optimal protein levels. So a good 30 grams of protein with every meal, especially, and you know, including breakfast, plenty of healthy fats throughout the day, lots of colorful fibrous vegetables and leafy greens. And also then when it comes to carbohydrates, we want to be focusing on complex slow release carbohydrates versus the refined white flour products, or, you know, lots of white rice or white pasta or white potatoes that break down very quickly into glucose. And also, if they're not balanced out with enough protein, they break down even quicker. But if we stick to the more complex versions of carbs, the ones that are full of fiber and break down slower, we can have a better handle on our blood sugar levels basically at any one time. So things like quinoa, brown rice, a small amount of sweet potato, or beans, lentils, baby new potatoes, whole wheat pasta or brown rice pasta, buckwheat pasta, for example, and just going with one closed fist size portion as opposed to sort of, you know, half a plate of carbs. So that's a really helpful way to balance blood sugar. Other little tips like avoiding snacking. So just ideally eating three square meals, three balanced meals throughout the day, throughout a sort of 12-hour period or a 10-hour period, and a good fast overnight of a minimum of 12 hours between finishing dinner and starting breakfast the next day is also helpful. I've got an episode on fasting. I think it's the one before this one, maybe episode 8 or 7. Sorry, I'm not up on the actual numbers of them, but you'll see in the title which one that is. So that might be helpful for you to listen to as well. And as I said, I'll do a whole episode on insulin resistance and blood sugar balancing as well soon. So insulin resistance can basically block ovulation from occurring as well. So very important that we are getting a handle on blood sugar balance. And then that brings me to my next point, which is making sure we are eating a nourishing diet. You know, we do have enough food coming in, enough energy, enough calories every day. And again, coming from proteins, healthy fats, good quality carbohydrates, plenty of colorful vegetables, nutrient dense animal proteins, preferably for your proteins. You know, lots of different nutrients are important for the process of ovulation. So we need, as I said, including as well as protein and healthy fats and good carbs, we need cholesterol, which comes from healthy fats. We need plenty of B vitamins, particularly B12, B6, folate, which predominantly come from animal foods. We need CoQ10, again, from animal foods. We need vitamin D, which we would ideally supplement with, because we just don't have enough sun in the UK to have enough. Iodine, magnesium, selenium, zinc. These are all really essential for a healthy corpus luteum to be formed, which is how we make progesterone. And then the number 5 is identifying and addressing potential underlying issues. So I talked about the sort of obstacles a minute ago. So kind of digging deeper if need be. So again, another reason for the decrease in progesterone or not being able to ovulate is things that we don't really realize are an issue. For example, chronic inflammation. We might not know that that's going on for us. Chronic inflammation usually comes from maybe an autoimmune condition, whether we know or we don't know. So that could be like rheumatoid arthritis or Hashimoto's, which is the thyroid autoimmunity, which is why it's important to test for those two thyroid antibodies I mentioned. It could be an unknown sensitivity to A1 cow's dairy. So if we're heavily relying on cow's milk and yogurt, for example, that could be an unknown sensitivity that can be increasing the situation of chronic inflammation in the body. Unknown sensitivity to gluten. We could have gut intestinal permeability, also known as leaky gut, which I'll do a whole separate episode on. We could have insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes. We could have ongoing gut infections that we don't know about, like pathogenic bacteria, some parasites, some yeast overgrowth, some just various, you know, imbalances in bacteria. We might have H. pylori infection. We could have ongoing viral infections that we don't know about, for example. So anything that's causing chronic inflammation can impact, again, our ability to ovulate, because it is a stressor. It's a physiological stressor. So the same way the stress is always that the brain is always scanning for stress, I mentioned, and it's maybe looking at you being stuck in traffic and stressed out about getting to work on time. It sees that as a threat. It also sees chronic inflammation, blood sugar imbalances as a threat as well. And then finally, we can try supplementing with Vitex. This is something I've personally found very helpful with myself, but also with clients in practice as well. So Vitex is also known as chaste tree berry or chaste berry or Agnus castus. So it's got a few different names. The one I use is just called Vitex. I think I use the brand Solaray. So Vitex is basically a herbal medicine prepared from the berries of the Mediterranean tree, Vitex agnus castus. That's why it's got a lot of different names. It's been shown to sort of modulate the brain's production of luteinizing hormone, which you might know of as LH, whilst at the same time mildly inhibiting FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, which supports the ovulatory process and helps to produce progesterone. So additionally, Vitex might have calming effects on the nervous system as well. So can be known as what's known as an adaptogenic herb, which can calm the nervous system. So that's also important for supporting ovulation, because we've talked about stress management being important for supporting ovulation. And it may relieve symptoms of breast pain, water retention, and irritability. For me, I've always been prone to breast pain before my period. In the last year or so, I've been some months, even though I know I've ovulated because my temperature has spiked a little bit, I've had breast pain sort of maybe even 10 or 7 days before my period. And sometimes it's been debilitating. And when I try taking Vitex for a few months, the breast pain disappears. So at the moment, I'm taking Vitex. I've been taking it now for the last 6 months. I'm probably going to stop soon because it actually works better if we take it for a maximum of 6 months and then take a break and then maybe go back to it a few months later. So it's really worked for me in terms of breast pain, maybe even sleep and irritability, but breast pain is the one thing that I've definitely noticed it helps with. So your brain will be most receptive to Vitex in the morning. So take it as part of your sort of morning routine. Get up and have your water. Hopefully you're hydrating yourself every morning. If you've got any other morning supplements, put Vitex with them. And then because it works to promote ovulation, you should start taking it early in the follicular phase. So ideally start taking it around day six or seven of your cycle. So day one being the day you started your period. So on day six or day seven, start taking Vitex, continue taking it every single day until your next period comes, then take a break for 5 days, again, 5 or 6 days, and start taking it again, and so on. Repeat month after month after month for up to 6 months, then take a little break for a couple of months or so, and then start it again if need be. You might find that you don't need it because the symptoms haven't come back. But if you do find you need it, then go back to it. It's just nice to have that little break after 6 months, just so that the positive effects of it, you know, don't start to attenuate and you just get your body just really adapts to it and it stops working. And that's why the 5 or 6 day break each month is also helpful. So I really hope this episode has been helpful and that you've learned something new and actionable. And I'd really love it if you found it helpful, if you would be happy to leave me a review or give me 5 stars on whichever podcast platform you're using, because this is the only way that the podcast is going to grow and reach more people. And I really hate asking for reviews. I've always been so bad at asking clients for testimonials. I've always found it just horrible asking, but I do have to ask. So yeah, if you're listening to these episodes and you're finding them helpful, please do let the podcast platform know, because it would just really help me to grow the podcast. So thank you for listening, and I will see you in the next episode. Bye-bye. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.